Robin said before the service, I got to sing verse 2 of that song. It talks about the birds singing sweetly on the trees. The name Robin, it'll sink in later. Don't worry about it, okay? As it's sinking in, if you would find and locate your Bible and open up to that very first book of the Bible, Genesis chapter 1 and chapter 2 is where we'll start off here today. One last chance to put your hands up and scream a little in churches today, because we've been screaming through a new sermon series all along that has to do with what a roller coaster reveals about walking with Jesus, some lessons learned at Cedar Point, and we've used the playful setting of Cedar Point to characterize some powerful truths about what it means to follow Jesus Christ with all of our life. And so throughout the past month together, we've covered various topics that deal both with Cedar Point and following Jesus Christ. In week one, we covered anxiety, stress, and worry, right? Those are common things within an amusement park. I shared the humorous story, humorous for you, not so for me, about how the blue streak creates brown streaks at times there in life just because of the anxiety and stress over that different ride. And we covered, too, what does it mean for a follower of Christ then to deal with worry, stress, and anxiety? We also covered the topic about early entry. Val Raven in 20 minutes, Millennium Fours in 10, you can't beat that. And yet, truthfully, the platinum offer available through Jesus is that his kingdom isn't just for when you're 6 feet under. He genuinely desires to implant the start of his kingdom. He taught us to pray that way, right? Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. He wants early entry access for his followers, where he begins to implant the kingdom living on earth, not just when we're 6 feet under the earth itself. And then we covered the water renovation, right? Cedar Point, the main attraction for Cedar Point from its founding at 1870 even onwards was the water, and it went through a water renovation this past year. Soak City, no longer Soak City, it's now Cedar Point Shores Water Park, and we tied that into how God's been offering a water renovation of his own right, called Christian baptism, where our identity is changed, not from Soak City to Cedar Point Shores, but as a follower of Christ, our identity is linked together with Christ, of which baptism is an outward sign of that interlinking and that walk with God. And then just last week together, we covered the idea of spinning, and how tilt-a-whirl can tilt our world in all the wrong ways. Some cycles, some spinning patterns of sin that God desires to break so that he can set us on a new traction and trajectory in life. The Christian lifestyle is not meant to be spinning the tires in the mud. It genuinely is meant to be marching in a given direction that is closer to a walk and a relationship with Jesus Christ and following in his footsteps there. And so we covered last week how what Jesus did on the cross truly does forgive us of our past. And it frees us up to live differently in the future. And then he forms within us, by way of his Holy Spirit, a new pattern and a new way of living. That, yes, there's some cultivating and some growing up and some maturing that needs to be done, but the new birth takes place when we come to faith in Jesus, and it's us to form that, working alongside the Spirit, churning up in our life that builds us and makes us into these faith-filled believers of Jesus Christ together. The importance of not spinning cycles, but moving forward with traction and trajectory closer to a walking and living relationship with Jesus himself. That's where we've been all sermon series long, and truthfully, I would love to just belabor this sermon series. There's so many more, right, within the parallels. Even the hands up thing, throwing the hands up there, and the need to throw our hands up and surrender and reach up to God, and how that forms us in our faith-filled walk and relationship with Jesus Christ himself. Or we could cover other topics there as it relates to Cedar Point, like the lights. That's, I think, my favorite part about Cedar Point. The lights, they're on like all day, you realize that, but it's at nighttime when they're most vividly displayed. I'm sure that there is a sermon on theodicy and all that. That is, in bad times, how does a Christian approach bad times, and why do bad times, times of suffering, times of trial happen within the life of a believer? I'm sure there's depths of sermons that we could still cover between Cedar Point and walking with Christ together, but we're closing it today. And we're going to close it today in this way. I want to talk to you one last time. One last lesson from Cedar Point dealing with hollow weekends. That's what's coming up in the life and the calendar of Cedar Point, Hollow Weekends. It's a fun time of year in the life of Cedar Point where the flowers are replaced by pumpkins and the blooms are replaced by corn stalks and the weather changes. You're no longer standing in line just sweating and just sweating and just sweating, but the cool, gentle breeze of the fall changes, the season changes. There can be some added interest in those regards, but there's some scary things with Hollow Weekends as well. We don't stay after dark in Hollow Weekends. We like the lights during the season. With three young kids, we don't stay after dark for Hollow Weekends, and because the theme along that is haunts and some skeletons and some curses and the like of that, and that's not for the three children. It's not for me personally there either, and so we stay away from the nighttime hours, but I'm going to talk not about Cedar Point's Hollow Weekends yet again. I want to talk about the hallowing of weekends that God had in mind that the very first pages of Scripture actually point to. And it's not a hollow weekend that's filled with haunts and curses and skeletons. The hallowing of the weekend that God is referring to in Genesis 1 and 2 isn't for curses, but it's actually for blessing. It's not to make a skeleton out of you, but it's actually to add to the fullness of life and make you more alive in this life if we would follow the hallowing of weekends as God has outlined in Genesis 1 in Genesis 2. And so that's where I want to turn the pages to today. Look at God's intent for the original hallowed weekend that he created in that first week of creation located in Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. And so hopefully Bibles are open, and I'm guessing it's going to be located near page 1, right? Genesis 1, Genesis 2, we're around page 1, yeah? Genesis is the book of beginnings. Actually, Genesis means beginnings or origins themselves. And so it's a talk, the whole book is dedicated to beginnings of different things. Genesis 1 and 2, the beginnings of the universe, the beginnings of human beings, and later on the beginnings of this certain group of people, this faith-filled people that God is crafting and carving out within the story of the Old Testament. So it's filled with beginnings. We want to look at the beginnings of the universe. And you'll notice in Genesis 1:1, it begins in this way. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, actually, that Feasting on the Faith class that we're offering, we spend a whole session that's really dedicated to this verse and the beginnings of what it means that God created the heavens and the earth, what difference that makes for our life, and how did he do it? We cover some of the scientific questions and theories associated with that. That's my plug for the Sunday, okay, with Feasting on the Faith in mind. But we talk about that. We rehash that for a whole session together about what's possibly in mind. I want to turn to the end of the creation week, to the seventh day, specifically because something significant happens that God does along the lines of hallowing the weekends. If we had time to read all of Genesis 1, you would see a repetition of themes throughout Genesis 1 that Genesis 2 then carries into. I mean, God is saying something. On one day, he's saying, let there be light. On another day, he's saying, let there be land. On another day, he's saying, let the land produce animals and human beings and sea creatures and all this. But you see this repetition of God speaking something, God seeing, he sees that it is good, and then God declaring that it is good then. He says something. He sees it happening. It's like everything is following after his word there. It just brings forth life. And then he declares something about that. And that is its state, its moral capacity. That is its goodness. There's that repetition throughout Genesis 1 together. And it leads to the seventh day of creation that is significant for what we're going to talk about today, starting in chapter 2, verse 1 of chapter 2, but the same theme in mind. Verse 1 of chapter 2 reads this. Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, all the host of them. And on the seventh day, God finished his work which he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all the work which he had done. Now, I don't know this from personal experience here, and maybe you do or don't as well, but I'm guessing the creating of the universe is hard work. To an extent there, right? I mean, that there's got to be a lot of work that comes into play of all the different creatures and adjusting Earth's axis at just the right tilt there and just enough atmosphere so that we don't burn up from the sun's rays, but just enough to keep the warmth in so that we don't freeze up when we're away from the sun. I'm imagining that there's a lot of work that goes into the work of the universe, and yet God takes a moment at the end of the week to do something significant, and that's to rest. He's modeling something for us. Because if we were following the progression of Genesis 1 onwards, it was in day 6 where God created human beings. And so all of a sudden here, these human beings that God has created need an example, need a model, need something to follow. Because it says of human beings, that's you and me, our forefathers, the original ones, that we were made in the image of God. And so how do we know who we are apart from who God is? And so I think in day 7, God's doing something where he's modeling. He's starting to show an example of what it looks like to be reflectors of God. That is not a visual aspect there, but what life should look like in a pattern of life. And one of the first things he models for you and me is this rhythm between work and rest. Not all work, not all rest. There needs to be a rhythm and a pattern that's found between work and between rest together. And that's going to be important because, right, what we're called is human beings, right? Not human doings, but human beings. And so God is trying to instruct us about what it looks like to find our being. Not in something we've done or accomplished, but in who he's made us to be. That's what's so significant about this first hollow weekend. God is trying to teach us something important about ourselves that sin is going to twist and mar. Because today, when we introduce ourselves to someone, it's often associated with what we've done in life, right? Our place of employment, or how many children we have, or the family structure that we're born into. Something that's done about us there. And God's trying to recenter us back in it all, that you're significant beyond anyone else or anything like a trophy or a paycheck or something says about you. You're significant because you bear the mark of the Maker. You're made in the image of God himself. You're a human being even before you're a human doing. And so God is modeling that even off the start there. This rhythm between work and rest. It's an important rhythm to find in life, right? Not all work and no rest, because then we just label ourselves by what we've done. But not all rest and no work either, right? Life isn't meant to be playing video games all day or barely paying the cable bill because you've been sitting on the couch all day watching the cable thing. There's a rhythm. There's a rhythm between a proper navigating of life, between work and rest, and God is trying to model that from the very first work week itself. Day 7, he pauses. The 7th day from all the work he's done, and verse 3 says this, so God blessed the 7th day. Hear that. God blessed it, right? Not cursed it, not, oh, this is going to tick humanity off here. Let's make a 7th day like this that's going to be filled with, no. God blessed the 7th day and he hallowed it. Set it apart, something different, something significant about that. He hallowed it. The very first hollow weekends, you might say. And because on it, God rested from all his work, which he had done in creation. And now this must be significant what God did the first week. Because he didn't forget about it then when he's starting to cut and create a people of God in the Old Testament. He cuts and carves out, if we continue down in the Old Testament story, he's trying to drill through people's heads what it looks like to be a follower of God in the midst of the world that you live in. And so he cuts and carves out a group of people so that group of people then teaches the whole world what kind of God he is and what he expects of us. That's the trajectory and trajectory of the Old Testament story. And so he starts with this faith-filled man named Abraham, and he's trying to teach him so that he can be a light for the rest of the world, pointing the rest of the world to the kind of goodness that God is and the life that he expects from us there. That's the story of the Old Testament in a nutshell. And in the course of that carving out and cutting out a group of people, he gives them 10 laws to live by. That is 10 ways that life works best, not only on the individual level, but on the societal level. Like if you follow these 10 laws to live by, things will go better for you yourself and for the community you live in. He's trying to teach his people how life works best in the midst of a fall of sin and this break of a relationship with God and with another. He's trying to put the pieces back together. And part of the putting the pieces together are those 10 laws to live by, which we know of better as the 10 commandments. And God gives his people the 10 commandments in actually the next book. It's Exodus. And so if you flip over just one book from Genesis, locate Exodus chapter 20, you'll see these 10 laws to live by. And we even got them projected on the screen if you can't find it in your Bible. Exodus 20 says this, just picking up in verse number 8 of Exodus 20. This is number 4 on that list of 10 ways to live by. You know some of them, like number 1 has to do with keeping God number 1 in the life. There's a priority and a trajectory of life, and life just works best when we recognize it's looking ultimately to Him and not to something else. And then like number 2 has to do with not putting something else in the place of Him, not carving out an image or an idol or something like that. In other words, God's trying to say, don't replace the worship of the Creator with a created thing. Don't try to imitate or impersonate or do anything like that Him. Just leave God as God there, and don't try to personify Him or worship a created thing over the Creator itself. Or number 3, don't speak of God lightly. Don't use His name in a way that's not in congruence with His character or who He is. It's some laws to live by. The first 4 have to do with our walk with God, and the next 6 have to do with how we live among the society or among people there. You know, laws like don't covet, don't steal, don't lie, those kinds of things. Number 4, though, on that list is this one that we're going to read right here. God says this: remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. In it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter or your manservant or maidservant, your cattle or the sojourner who is within your gates. For 6 days the Lord made the heaven and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, and He rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day, and He hallowed it. And so part of the reason between God giving this command is He's pointing back to what He had done at the very beginning, pointing back to the work of creation within that Ten Commandments Himself. And I know how we hear this commandment today, or at least how I've heard it. You know, sometimes you just grunt your teeth. God, you're just giving me one of these extra laws to live by. And what do you think? And you know it's hard enough obeying those other 9 commandments. Why are you giving me this hard one that has to do with work and rhythm and finding that pattern in life? Remember who God's given this to, this list of 10 commandments initially to. It's in the book of Exodus. That's where the people of Israel were slaves for over 400 years. That God is now speaking out to them, and He's saying, take a day off. Like 400 years, the great-great-great-grandfathers being forced to work under Pharaoh were there told in a real way that you're only as good as what you produce. And that, no, you're only good to me because of what you're bringing to me, not because of who you are. And slave-driven, literally, by Pharaoh himself for over 400 years. And now God steps in and He says, the way that I've designed your life to work best, the pattern and structure and rhythm that I want you to find your step to is 6 days work, 1 day off. For people who over 400 years had never had a day off are now given by their God 1 day each and every week. A day to define themselves, not by what they've done or the work that they've accomplished, but simply to find themselves in the presence of God and to rest and reflect and rejuvenate within that. Now, this commandment wasn't given to suck life out of people or to make us feel guilty about one more thing that we're breaking in our walk with God. This law was given out of a great care by the Creator, who's speaking to people overworked and overrun by life, saying, you're not what you've done or all the things that's said about you. Find your place in my presence. Soak and sit with where I'm at. Take a moment to recreate, rejuvenate. 1 day out of 7. We can hammer out, you know, the significance of the day in itself there. But I think the main point in all of this is that 1 out of 7, to not stare at the calendar, but to stare at our Creator. We'll unpack that a little bit later there. You know it's been abused, though, right? Within personal lives and within the story of Scripture. Jesus himself, right? The model, Hebrews tells us of Jesus, he's the pioneer and perfecter of the faith. That is, he's cut the path, and he helps lead us along in that path. Pioneer and perfecter, cutting the path, leading us forward in that path. Jesus came truthfully to not only cut the path in our life, forgive us and free us to move forward, but he also came to help guide us along, take us by the hand, you might say, to walk through this trail of where he's leading us. And Jesus himself, points to the significance of Sabbath keeping within his own life. As a matter of fact, it was one of those butting head points between Jesus and the religious leaders of his day. Because you know this law can be abused, right? In Jesus' day, the law was abused as well by some people. He had some people that thought Sabbath keeping, they wanted to be so pure, so sure that they were following God's Sabbath laws, that they put laws around the Sabbath law. Like, they made this law on steroids itself. And so they had some laws about how far you could or could not walk on a Sabbath day. Maybe that's why some of us cringe when we mention Sabbath day, right? You're thinking of someone saying, oh, you can't play ball on that day. Or you can't go to the mall on that day. Or these list of do's and do nots that are associated to the Sabbath day. Instead of this good gift by God, Jesus had those kind of people in his day. They wanted to make a checklist. You can do this on the Sabbath day. You can't do this on the Sabbath day. Otherwise, you're breaking God's law. Or you can do this, but you can't do that. And so some of those things on the do not list was that you can't walk a certain distance. That is, even more than 5/8 of a mile. If you walk further than a Sabbath day's journey, that they called it there, that you were breaking the Sabbath day. They had some other laws out there. Like, you couldn't spit on the Sabbath day, because if you spit, then it might churn up the soil, and that would be counting as planting or harvesting on the Sabbath day. And so don't spit on the Sabbath day, lest you break that. Even some of the more strict sects said that you couldn't have a bowel movement on the Sabbath day. Shows you how strenuous some of those bowel movements must have been. I'm saying just eat fiber on Friday. You'll be okay on the Sabbath day. But some of the more strict sects of religious leaders in their day saying, no, not even a bowel movement, lest that's considered working on the Sabbath day and then you break God's law. That's the kind of people that Jesus is talking to at points. This list of do's and do nots that want to see God's commandments as a checklist. I'm inside the bounds or I'm outside the bounds. And to those people, Jesus made this clear call about the purpose and intent of the Sabbath day. Hear this about why God has originally hallowed the weekends themselves. The story is found in Mark, and Jesus is on the Sabbath day. He's going through the grain fields with his disciples, his 12 followers, and they begin to pick some heads of grain as they're walking through the fields. So they're walking itself, maybe even further than a Sabbath day journey, and they're picking some heads of grain as they're walking through the fields. And the Pharisees said to him, look, why are they doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath? That would be considered harvesting. They're walking through a field, they're picking some grains, they're harvesting, and not to mention, the pedometer says maybe they're over 5/8 of a mile, and so they're breaking that one too. What are they doing? The Pharisees are asking. And Jesus answers by pointing to an Old Testament story of David. We won't get too much into, but he says, have you never read that David and his companions did when they were hungry and in need? In the days of Abiathar the priest, he entered the house of God, he ate the consecrated bread, which is lawful only for the priest to eat, and then he gave some to his companions. Here's where he comes down on the matter, the summary of it all. Jesus says this, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. Jesus is trying to clarify why God first hallowed the weekends in the first place. And the Pharisees and religious leaders thought God first hallowed the weekends just to put another burden on man's back. Another spreadsheet to add to the list of where I'm breaking, where I'm out of step with God. And Jesus says, no, time out. The real reason why my Father had first hallowed the first weekends was he was thinking about you. He did it out of care for you. This Sabbath was made for you, because you're going to hear a message in this world that you're only as significant as what you've done, or you're only about what you've accomplished, and God's trying to recenter you and re-swivel your head and saying, no, it's not about what you've done or who you've been. I love you. Rest in my love. Be reminded of my love. Take a moment to pause and reflect on my love for you. Or all the other host of characteristics of who God is. God had his intent in mind was us when he's given us the Sabbath day itself to hallow the original weekend together. And so what are some guidelines? With God's good gift to us today, not another law to add to the list of the things I've broken in life, but if God truly knew best how the human being was meant to function and run, like if God, our creator, genuinely knew the intent of the creature and knew the rhythm that our life will best work under, if God really knew all that about us, which the Bible would claim and I believe he does, then how should my life look to get the best and the fullness out of it so that I don't come to a skeletal existence, but that my life shows and manifests the fullness of what God designed? That is worthwhile work, but also rest that recalibrates and recreates and rejuvenates in all the right ways. How would that look for my life if God, the good creator, genuinely gave this day as a gift of care to the creatures that he had made? Well, I think at least three things of what the passage that we just read points out about how God designed the Sabbath day to best work. And first and foremost of those, the Sabbath day, the hallowing of the weekend that God had in mind, was to reflect on God. To reflect on God. The Ten Commandments put it this way. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor. That is, there's a job to do and you're called to work at it. 6 days you shall labor, do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. There's a direction. There's a trajectory that life, a direction that our lives are to head, and that's ultimately to the Lord your God. And I capitalize Lord there. That's how it's capitalized within the text itself. It's using that personal name of God. The name that Moses was given at the burning bush. It's that name that's used of people in God's covenant people. That is in a walk and in a relationship with God himself. It's that personal name for God that highlights the need for a personal relationship with God. God is talking and reaching out to those who are walking in relationship to him and saying, this is the direction, this is the trajectory of your life there. Take one day out of seven to rest and recalibrate and to refocus on who God is. This is also a practice of what Jesus has done in the New Testament. We'll get to that in just a moment. But I think it points, and maybe you're going to hear this. Maybe you're going to hear this as a pastor pushing his agenda for a moment. Excuse me if it sounds that way. I don't mean it to come across that way, but I'm going to be honest. It's going to sound that way. I think part of what it means to reflect on God is to find yourself in worship. One out of seven on a Sabbath day itself. To find yourself in worship. Yeah, I told you, you're going to hear that as the pastor pushing his agenda. I think that's important for what it means to reflect on God. And I think God gives that clue by how he introduces it. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. It's written in the book of Exodus. And throughout the book of Exodus, there's a building project that's going to be underway right after the Ten Commandments of a place designated, marked with God's holiness. And it's a place of worship with his people itself. Now, yes, there's a way to reflect on God without always going to a tangible building. Don't hear me wrong in that. But we are physical creatures. And so sometimes, oftentimes, what's most beneficial for us to reflect on God as physical creatures is to physically find a space where we encounter God in a deeper way within a building. And that's why this building has been designated. A set-apart place so that we go to for the express purpose of encountering God and growing deeper in our walk and our relationship with God itself there, to reflect his holiness in that way. He had a building like that too in this pages of Exodus. And the place I want to designate for you is even how he labeled this building. It was actually a tent in his day where his people were to go as an act of worship, corporate worship together. He called the outer perimeter the holy place. And then there was an inner place within that where the Ark of the Covenant was, where God's presence was in a palpable way there in that place, and he called that the most holy place. Remember what he said back in the Ten Commandments. Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. And then for much of Exodus, he's pointing to this place where his holiness is meant to be on display, where his holiness is meant to be manifest, and it's a physical location where he's calling his people. In an aspect of one out of seven to find themselves as a place of worship and to reflect on his presence in that way. When Jesus, God in human flesh, would come among us, it talks about his customs and his life, and it says this in Luke chapter 4, that Jesus went to Nazareth where he had been brought up, and on the Sabbath day he went into the synagogue as was his custom. this Jewish place of worship, Jesus being a Jew there, and the messianic hope, the Jewish hope there that he was coming to fulfill. And it says, as was his custom, that is his norm, that is his habit, Jesus's habit, Jesus's norm, the weekly flow, the regular rhythm of Jesus's life was 1 out of 7 to be in corporate worship together. I told you, you're going to hear this as a pastor pushing his agenda. But it's not as a pastor pushing his agenda ultimately. It says, how do we make this hallowing of a weekend, this rhythm that our Creator designed for the human creature to best flourish under, how do we get that as a rhythm within our life? Well, at least Jesus shows us and God commands it that 1 out of 7, we find it a chance to be in worship. I would argue that more than anything else in our life, how we approach the weekend might really say what we most value in life. Because in the weekend for many of us, not for all of us, but in the weekend for many of us is our one opportunity to really choose where I'm coming or where I'm going or what I priority in my life there. The weekend, more than anything, gives us that freedom and flexibility. And so if we took a look at your weekend schedule, I'm not going to do this, okay? But I invite you to do this. If you take a look at your weekend schedule, what would it say about what you value and what you prioritize in life? Does it show this attempt of reflecting and processing in this life and growing in the depth of a relationship with God or not? I do think Sunday worship is so important. I do think Sunday worship is so important. Maybe that's as a pastor, but when I see some of us not show up on a Sunday on a regular basis, it seems not showing up to church and distancing in our walk with God are located on the same block at times. Not all the times, but oftentimes are not showing up for worship and our distance in our walk with God. When that becomes deeply entrenched habits, oftentimes those two are on the same street, the same block together. But vice versa too. Oftentimes, not all the times, we can put on a good face, but oftentimes our Sunday attendance and weekly habits, norms of being together in this place of worship often shows that we have a sincere desire to grow deeper and more in love with who God is and to fall in this wonder and awe and mystery of who he is together. And we're growing in that way when we're showing up in that way. So oftentimes, more than anything else, the weekend reveals what we value or what we don't value within life itself. And so we just encourage you, as a part of God's howling of the weekends, to make Sunday worship. And that's maybe the point now to have this discussion too. The Sabbath day here was a Saturday, right? The first days of the week, if we're counting Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, the seventh day was a Saturday there. So why do Christians now gather as Sundays? There's a whole slew of reasons that I would love to talk to you about, maybe over a donut this week even there, about why we choose Sunday rather than Saturday. What's interesting of all the Ten Commandments, all of those are repeated in the New Testament except for one. Guess which one isn't repeated? The Sabbath day itself. And I think Jesus was showing in an aspect of that. Hebrews chapter 4, jot these down. Hebrews chapter 4, Colossians chapter 2. Those would be two places to look up where I think the significance lies. But I think Jesus, at least in part, is giving his followers a little bit of freedom in the Sabbath day to pick and choose a different day, because in a sense, he is the fulfillment of the rest. He is the fulfillment of what this day was pointing forward to. And there's a group of believers for over 4,000 years held true that the seventh day was the Sabbath day. And all of a sudden, after 4,000 years, they change it from Saturday to Sunday. I think once again, that points to the significance that something took place that original Easter, a Sunday, that people who don't change their tradition for nothing now all of a sudden have changed their traditions because they realize that with what Jesus has done on Easter Sunday, that the world is forever changed. Even the way we keep track of time has forever changed in that line. And so I think that's a big part of why you see Sunday rather than Saturday. But like I said before, I truly think if we're staring at the calendar and not at our Creator, then we've missed the point of the Sabbath day. 1 out of 7, God says to set apart as holy. And we do that by going towards the Lord our God itself. The direction and trajectory, the main point of the Sabbath day, is to find ourselves in the presence of God himself. Not to stare at a calendar, but to stare at our Creator. And to fall in love and the mystery and awe of him over and over and over again, each and every week of our life. That's point number one. Let's fly through these next two points there. The second point of why we need to hallow the weekend is or how we hallow the weekend, rather, is to rest on work itself. Right? That's the repetition between the Ten Commandments. He says, remember the Sabbath day, keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor, do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. In it you shall not do any work. There's a thrust for stopping from the work and to finding a new rhythm and a new pattern. And this is the point where Jesus clashed the most with the religious leaders, right? They wanted a checklist. This characterizes work. This isn't work. You know, you can walk this far and we know that you haven't worked, but if you walk a step further than that, you've officially worked. They wanted that kind of checklist. And maybe some of you want a checklist too. What constitutes as work and what doesn't constitute a work? What Jesus repeatedly says is, I'm not giving you a checklist. It's more about checking in with God. That if you're sincere about wanting to walk in step with God, then he's going to show you what constitutes as work or not work in that way. It's not a to-do list, people. It's truly about walking in relationship with God. That, yes, there's something to be different about this one out of seven. But I ain't going to tell you exactly what's to be different about it. I'm speaking there as Jesus, in essence there, of what his message was in that. I'll just give you a personal illustration. For me personally, mowing lawn is work. I've got some neighbors where mowing lawn isn't work. They enjoy that. I don't know how they enjoy that, but for me, it's a chore. It's a demand. And so on my day off, I ain't getting on the lawnmower. That's work for me. I ain't getting in the garden pulling weeds. That's work for me. Some of you love gardening. Some of you, that's relaxed. That's therapy to you. And so by all means, gardening isn't work to you. It's work to me. And so that's where I think Jesus leaves the ball in our court. Work is going to look differently based on the differences of the ways that he has wired you. Don't stare at the checklist. Stare at God through this, and he's going to help you navigate what constitutes his work and what doesn't. Which ways do I need to refresh and recreate, and which ways do I need to report for duty in those ways? There's to be a distinction, but not necessarily a legalistic distinction in that ways. And then thirdly, the significance of hallowing the weekends there. Hallowing the weekends is really good for outreach. It interests me in the Ten Commandments, when God makes mention of this law of Sabbath, he also makes mention of sons and daughters, of manservants and maidservants, that's people that are working with him, and even mentions the cattle, the creation itself. It's like this hallowing of weekends isn't just about you. And sometimes when I have the discussion with people there, they'll ask me the question there, can I be a Christian and not go to church? I'll express some of that importance of how church attendance and walking around the block is significant for that. But I also point them to this fact. Going to church isn't just about you. It's also about the person next to you in the pew, right? God gave us two ultimate laws to live by. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor. And so part of the reason why we come to church is definitely to stay in step with God, to love God. But the other part of why we come to church is because my going to church is important for the person sitting next to me too. And this corporate worship sense about the people of God, right? God gave us the imagery of a body of believers. You don't cut off the arm and feel like you're the fullness of what God has designed you to be in that instance of his body, of the church in that way. And so there's a part of us that really needs to be in church for the person next to us as well. And not only for the person next to us, but I'll tell you, your neighbor's aware of where your car is on Sunday morning. Your family, when they call you up for a family reunion that starts at 9 a.m., or at least by 12 noon, and you take at least 2 hours to get there, and then you show up late because the preacher went over, your family all of a sudden realizes that going to church is important to you, that you're even willing to miss 15 minutes of a family reunion, or maybe even longer, because going to church is a priority. You see what I'm saying? Sometimes we express that, I don't know how to share my faith to others. Well, one of the ways we share our faith is where we're at on the Sunday morning. Because our family, when they're plotting their schedules, they're going to be aware of that. Just a humorous story for one moment. My mom is planning a family-wide trip for us this upcoming November. And my own mother, who shares my values with it, the apple didn't fall from the tree in this. She really holds true and tries to model her life around Sabbath keeping in her own life. My own mother was trying to plot this trip, and the airfare, one of the plane dates there, had to take place with a Sunday morning. And my own mother, as she's just excited about this trip, all of a sudden turns to me, and the tone in her voice changes a little bit. She's a little more hesitant. And she talks about the airfare themselves there and how one of the options is on a Sunday morning itself. And I could hear the quiver in her voice even as she's sharing that to me. My own mother knows where I come down on the importance of being in worship and all that. You're wondering what we're electing to do and stuff. I'll tell you outside of this time there of what we're doing there. But the importance there, I think, of the further outreach, the family, the neighbors, all those in contact, realizing the priority and importance of hallowing the weekends. Hallowing the weekends. It's a great idea. It truly is. Cedar Point's on to something. But I think they stole the copyrights from elsewhere. And no, it's not the kind of hallowing weekends that is filled with curses and skeletons. God's hallowing of weekends is for blesses, that is to bless his people. And it's also to fill out their life, not to make them a skeletal existence of work, 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 but to show them a day off, one out of seven, where they can refresh, recalibrate, recreate in this reflection of who God is and what he's designed them and the ways he's designed them to flow through that. It's a good idea. It's a God idea. And may we implant that in our ideas as well. Amen. Amen.